What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Heart, heart.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink. We engage you, the listener, and interact on a different topic each week. We've got loads of good tunes, lovely music, and lots of analysis to keep you going.
And interviews from experts or you young people telling us what you think about our daily topic.
That's always the best part of the show, Jackson, to hear what the listeners have to say. There's always lots of juicy comments and lots of different perspectives. Absolutely,
so stay tuned. Welcome to Upfront, The Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, D.C. Nadia Sami is in Johannesburg, South Africa. Now, it has been said that the basic component of any country's knowledge system is its indigenous knowledge. That is a combination of the skills, experiences of people that has been applied for thousands of years to maintain or improve their livelihood. Scholars in this area agree that the significant contributions to global knowledge have originated from what people have indigenously collected for so many years, for instance, in the fields of medicine, agriculture, and many other aspects of our lives. Indigenous knowledge is developed and adapted continuously to changing environments and is passed down from generation to generation, and most often is closely interwoven with people's cultural values. Most importantly, indigenous knowledge is the social capital of millions of people in developing countries. This is their main asset to invest in their struggle for survival, to produce food, to provide for shelter, or to achieve control of their own lives in one way or another. However, as we've seen today, many indigenous knowledge systems are at a risk of becoming extinct because of rapidly changing economic, political, and cultural changes on a global scale. Practices, cultures, and people's ways of lives are becoming extinct because they adapt too slowly. And it's feared that this generation will not have access to knowledge that has been passed down by their ancestors from generation to generation. So today on the show, we'll look at some aspects of our indigenous knowledge systems, from the food we eat to the fashion. Something that would seem as merely aesthetic, but is of great value and importance to its society. Let's talk. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Let's listen to some of your comments and opinions on our topic today.
What I consider to be the indigenous way of Malawians in preserving food, mainly vegetables here in Malawi, local farmers collect the vegetables from the garden, for example, okra, and firstly they dry them in sun, and when they are done or when the vegetables get dried, these local farmers put them in clay pots as one way of keeping them for future use. And they can eat these vegetables throughout the year, even when the rains are not there.
Traditional dances like Manganje, for instance, it's unique because it is performed during initiation ceremonies when the initiates are coming out of the initiation. That's when most of the times Manganje is performed. But over the time, because of its uniqueness, because of the dance itself, we have seen it coming out even in times where there are no initiations, like maybe during political rally meetings, during other assemblies. We have seen now the dance itself coming out.
Voice of America. Hello, this is Upfront of Voice of America, and these are your opinions on the topic today.
Would see even the type of music that Malawians are doing, they're incorporating some part of Manganje in the music itself. So you would see that it's unique, and because of its uniqueness, people are trying to associate it with maybe with modern music, whereby they're taking the beat of Manganje, mix it with their lyrics and so on and so forth, and then come up with a good production. And you see that such music would attract indeed a lot of people because they see a traditional touch there, a touch they can associate with home.
My name is Pastor Gaiba from Brantaya, Malawi. I want to explain about how to prepare Malawian relish known as chigwada, which is made of cassava leaves. In fact, we take our cassava leaves and put it in a clean basin with water to wash it. After washing it, we put it in a clean winnower, then we pounding it. After that, we take the pot and put it on fire, and we wait for some minutes until water is boiling. We mix the water with salt and soda. We wait for some minutes to boil. Then after that, we will take tomato and groundnut powder. We wait for some minutes to boil. Then we take cooking stick for mixing our relish. Then we wait for 15 minutes. Then it's ready for eating with sima, which is hard porridge made from maize flour.
Now, Jackson, each African society has a set of knowledge that's unique to them. And that knowledge has created the basis for decision-making in things like agriculture, healthcare, education, and how the family is run.
That's true, Nadia. Now,
in Africa, our indigenous knowledge consists of practices and representations that have been crafted and perfected by communities with thousands of years of close interaction with the environment. In many communities, the people share common cultural and social ties and depend on each other for sustenance, for healing, farming, remedies, etc. Now, Abdi Latif Egger, a Somali writer currently based in Mombasa, Kenya, says that one of the main reasons for the erosion of African knowledge base was the tendency by colonialists to elevate Western knowledge at the expense of the sophisticated collections of information, understanding, and interpretations that guided our local societies, communities for centuries before their arrival.
Well, I think what has happened is that I think one has to go back to the whole idea of colonialism and its opposition to indigenous knowledge in general. And so you can now, from independent Africa or even before that, you can see how there was an emphasis in Western education, Western medicine, and Western things. So everything that had to do with native or what the colonies would call native and we're calling indigenous or right. African knowledge right. would be put back as something that is backward completely.
Right. Was looked down upon.
Yeah. Essentially, whatever started for the African, according to the nation state, which is in the 1960s, is colonialism, and after it, you know, it's the whole history of the African starts with the idea that they were discovered here in, for example, Lake Victoria.
But the irony here is that many of the components of modern medicine have roots in indigenous knowledge and medicines that we've been using for generations and generations.
It's very true, but at the same time, it is now again a reimposition that a lot of the West, having been tired of their those types of medical pharmaceutical things, are now trying to look at also homeopathic and natural medicines, which is one of the biggest proponents of is China and places like that. So there's a return to that, but I don't know how much that this return is, for example, African-centered, and I'm sure the people who are using it originally are still using it in some many ways, but there's been a co-option of that in terms of the whole edifice or the authority of African healing.
But there was still a level of knowledge transfer that was passed down generations, and it's possible that our mothers or grandmothers still possess this knowledge, even though...
Yes, there is. There are people who are still practicing. There's always, you know, what they have in Nairobi, for example, or Mombasa, or other places they might call themselves doctor or herbalist or things like that, but they're using traditional medicine from the Maasai, for example. From all these groups have their own things, which is still there, but the amount of people who consult them are very little.
So, Abdi, why is that? If they have the necessary knowledge and skills to provide services to their community, why don't people go to seek their services?
Yeah, that's the whole, it comes back to that whole idea that Western knowledge and Western so-called modernity is what is preeminent.
Mm. But
so, if you have no history of healing yourself, then, you know, you have to rely on these other things.
Right, right.
So-called, you know. But they have been, of course, traditional medicines and this and that. Some of them they've dubbed as witchcraft, some of them this and that. But herbs, you know, I think, for example, in the case of my particular family, there was no herbalist in the sense of that, but there was someone around that I knew who did that.
Who treated people in the neighborhood.
Not in the neighborhood, in an urban setting. But if you went to, for example, the nomadic setting in the nomadic Somali, for example, pastoral, you will find the people who are healing bones and doing all these things are just traditional.
So there's a legitimate body of knowledge that exists. Even not to say that there's no quackery or, you know, shoody medicine man.
I think the question is more, you know, the conceptual idea that everything that has to do with Africa has problems. Modern medicine does not necessarily incorporate African herb and all that. So yeah, that's the whole point, is that the chances of someone like saying, okay, well, I'm going to go see a herbalist now rather than going to see a regular doctor is very, you know, the occurrence is less and less and less.
Now greetings to the world. The cumulative intelligence of mankind is what makes us special amongst all other species. Everything is built upon the foundation before it. These ancient thoughts, this ancient love, these ancient hearts, these ancient souls, these ancient songs, these ancient people.
Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, D.C. Nadia Sami is in Johannesburg, South Africa. Today we're talking about indigenous knowledge systems, the importance. We've talked about this before on our show, but it's an extensive, wide topic that we feel we should revisit once in a while. Each cultural group has its own set of knowledge. It has its own process of learning, of sharing, social life, and this is often reflected. It reflects the uniqueness of ways that the society makes the meaning of the world around them. But what happens when that set of knowledge, of symbols, practices are embraced as part of a wider dominant knowledge system or culture? I mean, we do live in a globalized society. So the question is, does it need to be acknowledged? Now, Lola Noor, who has been on the show previously, thinks so. She says that when we use other people's symbols from their cultures, we need to acknowledge it. And she started a social media campaign to bring attention to what she called cultural appropriation by a major American clothing chain that was selling a traditional dress from her homeland without adequately attributing its source, its context, its culture.
The reason we started this campaign is basically because we found out that Urban Outfitters was selling a dress, a traditional Ethiopian and Eritrean dress, on its website as a vintage 90s linen item for $209.
What, $209?
$200, yep, okay. $209. Mm. And there was no labeling in terms of the country of origin or, you know, where the design was inspired from. And I know that when I'm Ethiopian and Eritrean, and so when I first saw the dress, like, the first thing that came to my mind was, this is mine. Like, this is my culture. This is not American. This is not vintage. You know, like, this is something literally my mom would wear to a wedding, okay, or, you know, like something very traditional.
So, they've been selling this dress without giving credit to the culture of origin. How did you know about this dress being sold by this company, Urban Outfitters?
I first found out through Twitter. A friend tweeted me an Instagram picture that she took, that she found somehow, of the dress, and said something like, you know, isn't this like our culture? Why is Urban Outfitters selling it with no labeling? And so I did some more research. I went to their website, typed in, you know, the item number, like the code, and that's the dress that came up. And sure enough, there was no labeling or, you know, credit being given to Ethiopia or Eritrean culture. And in fact, it says made in USA. And so I started a Twitter rant, basically, and I started a hashtag. It's called My Culture Not Outfit. And I realized that, you know, a lot of people are actually angry about this. So I decided we need to start a petition.
Is it possible that this has been happening for many years and that for over the past couple of decades, Ethiopian, Eritrean, or in general African design has already entered American mainstream culture, and that they don't need to give credit where it originated from because people will automatically know where it is from? Like you said, if I saw a kimono, I would know it is from Japan. I don't necessarily need to see made in Japan on the kimono.
Right. See, and I think that's where it gets a little tricky is that, you know, yeah, we are living in a very globalized world. And so it is very easy to share ideas, to be inspired by different cultures, and that's normal and that's fine. I'm not against, you know, being innovative. I'm not against being creative. I'm really not against that. I just wish that, you know, if companies are going to take from, you know, other cultures, like, don't try to turn it into this, like, latest fad trend without at least saying, you know, this came from this country or this came from this culture. And it is possible that this has happened before and we just didn't know about it. But because of social media, we were able to, you know, spread the information, and that's why people are taking action.
Now, some people would say that there's a certain prestige, a pride, or bragging rights that come with knowing that somebody is actually enjoying your culture. If you walk down the street and find somebody putting on a shirt from your culture, that should be a good thing, and it should not necessarily be viewed as being negative, and, you know, we should embrace it.
I do, and that's another reason why I'm also a little bit torn about this idea of feeling flattered that our traditional items are entering the mainstream, is that, yes, I do think there's going to be a drawback of that, which is they are going to be, the significance of them is going to be cheapened. If any random person is wearing, you know, like an Ethiopian or Eritrean traditional item just on the street with flip-flops and jeans or something like that, then that does take away from the significance and the cultural meaning and the knowledge, you know, that came with that. And the art also, that's another aspect of this. The weaving and the dyeing and the fabrics and just the process that it takes to make these kinds of dresses by hand, you know, those are traditional. It's artwork. But if companies like Urban Outfitters are just going to sell it on the website and not even provide any context, any cultural knowledge, none of that, I just think it comes down to it's being disrespectful. So, yes, I do believe that it's cheapening the significance and the meaning, very much so.
There are some things like treating vegetables so that maybe people should eat later on, like pumpkin leaves, we call it in food, so that like they dry them and keep them. Then they can be ate at a later stage. That is still on, but it's not often as it used to be because of maybe the coming in of our technology.
We have a lot of herbs, and we have indigenous herbs which are very useful in the treatment of our ailments like malaria, so many stomach aches, even worms. So we have all these herbal medicines. Also, they are also treating us. They are also helping us in the treatment of some of the diseases we have. I have a number of people in the communities who have never even gone to the hospital, and they are depending on that. There are so many.
Now, Jackson, this knowledge is passed down from one generation to the next, and generally it provides a holistic view of how to use local natural resources based on traditional ethical perspectives to solve local problems.
You're very right. It was passed down from one generation to another, and it basically taught them how they survived. Now, you look at her and imagine that's such a very trivial aspect of an indigenous knowledge base, right? But it's very important because it's an identifier, and they say you are the hair that you wear, right? Olusha Shegun is a young Nigerian student. She says that she takes pride in maintaining her natural hair because it is reflective of her culture, but most importantly, of a knowledge that has been passed down generation to generation, and she hopes to pass on to her young sister.
I would always wear braids when I was younger, from about when I was, I want to say 12 till the time I was 18. And there were the times where I would have to wear my natural hair to school. I was ashamed. And it killed me. I was like, why would I be ashamed from what is naturally growing from my head? So even then, with being ashamed, I decided to stop perming my hair because I had read many reports that it's very dangerous.
Do you find that many young people like yourselves are hesitant to embrace indigenous fashion or design, hair in the face of Western pop culture?
I will say yes, just due to the fact that by me wearing my hair like this, it means I'm Afrocentric. But why should it mean I'm Afrocentric? Why can't a white person can wear their hair straight, curly, whatever style? That doesn't mean anything. But if a black person decides to wear their hair the natural way it grows from their head, then yeah, there's something like Afrocentric or African about you, right? Which is not a big deal, but I don't think
so. You're basically going against the grain in a way.
Exactly.
Yet it's actually the natural way.
It's so funny. Exactly. It's ironic. I'm like, you were taught from a young age to hate your hair. It's insane that when I was 19, that's when I started to learn about my hair. Now I'm 22. I mean, whereas you have your other friends from other cultures, they've had their entire lives to learn how to maintain, to take care of their hair. But yeah, it's very hard.
Did your mother or your grandmother give you any knowledge about how to maintain your natural look, your natural hair?
You know, they didn't. I was...
Any quote-unquote African knowledge?
It's so funny. My grandmother is from Brazil, so her hair is completely different from my hair. My mom is half Brazilian, half Nigerian, so our hair is a little bit... Our hair is a little bit different than one another's hair, but they didn't give me any tips at all, if anything. My mom put a perm in my hair when I was, 5, 6, so I had no choices. Like, my hair was perm from the time I was a child. And the thing is, I'm like, they could easily use, the products they use in their hair is incompatible with what we use for our hair, but we're forced to use it, and it's not labeled as other, so...
And so because for such a long time, the standards have been set based on this canvas, the white canvas, the Caucasian canvas.
Yeah.
There has been very little knowledge that has been passed down to young people like yourself, how to maintain ethnic beauty, so to say, indigenous beauty or African beauty or black beauty.
Everything. Makeup. It's just...
Now, nobody really taught me how to take care of my hair.
You know, it's different because for you, it's very different if you're trying to, grow your hair out. If I was to leave my hair short now, that's a completely different story. When my hair was about your hair length, honestly, I would wash it, put some oil in it, and that was it. And I would wrap a scarf, and then I was going for the day just so that the oil doesn't get on my pillow and then affect my skin.
But I don't put oil. The extent of my knowledge about how to maintain my hair as a man, as an African man, is that I just wash it. Why isn't that the same standard that women use to look after their hair?
Because there's so much else that goes into it. Your hair looking appearance and what's actually going on in your scalp are two different things. My hair looks fine, but if you look closely enough, you can see split ends and all those things. I think for women, because we're trying to maintain length, for a man it's not the same issue.
You're trying to maintain length?
Length,
okay,
yeah, exactly.
So grow it
you're
out?
You're trying to grow your hair out.
Okay,
so
the longer
different.
It grows, the harder it is to maintain.
Yeah, there's more work you actually have to do because, like I was telling you, the black hair texture, even just my hair, for example, it's so funny because when we walked in here, you're like, our hair is the same length, but I'm like, my hair is so much longer than yours, but you wouldn't be able to necessarily tell by just looking at me. Your hair shrinks 75% for the kind of hair texture I have. So if I wash my hair is like this now. By the time my hair dries, it's gone back to the little afro.
Who is investing in research and knowledge about hair products for African women? Is it Africans
or Western companies?
You know, it's honestly a mixture of both, because there's a vacuum right now. You need someone to say that I'm the clear leader in this field, and you have African-American women, Africans who are trying to develop these products, but also you have Western people who are kind of like, I need to, there's a lot of money in this industry. Even look at hair stores. When you go to buy hair for your extensions, they're in the United States, they're run by Asian people, Koreans or Chinese people. So everyone is trying to figure out a way to capitalize off of this vacuum right now. And the sky, and the sea, and the birds,
and the trees, and the songs, the melodies. Tobena Ebubechukwu is from Nigeria. He says that indigenous knowledge and information has sustained his people for centuries, including in times of peace and in times of conflict. Tell us a little bit about some of the indigenous knowledge of the Igbo people, some, you know, Igbo education, traditional education. Are there things that exist, sets of knowledge that exist among the Igbo people, the Igbo culture, that we probably would not be able to get if we read in the history, in history books or science books or technology books?
Absolutely. I have to start with even the, you know, Biafra, the Nigerian Civil War. And we see a situation in which the Igbo people of Nigeria actually made their own guns. You know, they made their own weapons because, unfortunately, Biafra fought the rest of Nigeria.
Mm.
And, you know, the weapon supply were cut off from by the British and the Americans and the French, which supported the Nigerian side. And it's funny that the Biafra, the Igbo Nigerians, had to actually produce their own weapons. So, you know, Igbo people have had science, Igbo people have had technology. One of the great things about the Igbos is their folk tale ability and their literacy, of their literature ability.
How rich is the indigenous knowledge in Igbo land in terms of medicine, and how has that been adapted probably by modern science?
Wow, thank you for that question. I really appreciate it. Yes, the Igbo culture has, you know, has always had different techniques to cure, you know, medicinal issues. Number one, I remember when you have boils, instead of taking antibiotics, which is the Western way of life, a lot of times what the Igbo culture will do is they'll take what you call palm oil. It's from the palm kernel tree, because a lot of palm kernel trees grow in the eastern part of Nigeria. And they will use the palm oil and apply it like a pomade or like a lotion on the boil, and the boil will burst. These are like indigenous ways of curing, you know, of medicinal treatments inside of Western notions of, you know, using antibiotics or using westernized means of medicinal treatments. There have been different cures. One of the ways that some of the Igbo people of Nigeria believe in receiving medicinal treatment is in what is better known as the African traditional religion, which is the, you know, use of the herbalist or the medicinal man.
Mm.
Unfortunately, I don't ascribe to that particular use of medicine because I don't believe in that type of tradition. But those are some of the means that the Igbo people have also, you know, brought their own cultural into medicinal field instead of relying on the Western notions of. Also, there are herbal drinks, you know, drinks made from trees in the Igbo land. And when you have like a regular headache or diarrhea, you're able to drink these kind of, it's kind of like a tea, you know, some drinks, and people drink them and they feel better.
Thank you very much for listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I would like to thank my co-host Nadia Sam in Johannesburg, South Africa. If you have any questions or comments or want to contribute to the show in future, remember to send us an email at upfront@voanews.com. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, my handle is @UpfrontAfrica. Let's connect again next week, right here, same time. On behalf of my colleague Nadia Sami, my name is Jackson Vunganyi. Goodbye.